The same religion that's capable of hideous acts of destruction can also be capable of moments of healing, of restoration, and of hope.
But educate a girl, and you educate her entire family.
There is a son within every person.
When that anger sets in, write it. Write the letters, but don't send them. You never want to leave concrete proof of insanity.
Well, welcome. My name is Mark Juergensmeyer. I'm director of the Orfila Center of Global and International Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. I'd like to welcome all of you here at Santa Barbara and also to our television audience to this very special event. We're delighted to have back with us Ambassador Barbara Bodine, who's had a distinguished career in the Foreign Service, serving in the Far East and in various points in the Middle East, including Yemen and Baghdad. But it all started right here in Santa Barbara when she was an undergraduate many years ago in Near Eastern Studies. And then she went to the Foreign Service. She studied at the Fletcher School. They sent her to the Far East, where she began her career in diplomacy. And from there to the Middle East, where she had posts in Baghdad and Iraq back before when it was still under Saddam. And then finally to Yemen, which she thought was going to be a quiet posting in a lovely and exciting place until the USS Cole. And all hell broke loose, and she was in the middle of a maelstrom trying to intervene between the Yemeni government, who felt offended by that al-Qaeda attack themselves, as well as the American investigatory agencies that came pouring in, and exhausted from that brilliant tour of duty, she was given a couple years leave of absence to come to Santa Barbara. And that's when we encountered her as a visiting professor in global international studies a professor in a number of our courses on diplomacy and Middle Eastern studies and in conflict resolution, until one day in the middle of a course that she was teaching on international intervention, she received the call that she was to be a part of our own intervention. And that, of course, was in Baghdad. She was called upon to be a part of the reconstruction team that would come to Baghdad, and she was to be in charge of Al-Anbar province and Baghdad, the central region, and she had all kinds of ideas about how a reconstruction could take place, some of which were listened to, alas, though, not all, because there she was in the middle not only of the confusion after the invasion, but also of competing interests, both from the local leaders in Iraq and the Pentagon, over exactly which way the reconstruction efforts should go. She was there for a little over a month before a new reconstruction team came in, perhaps a little bit more faithful to the Pentagon's ideas of the way in which the reconstruction should go in Iraq, and then went back to the State Department for a year, ended up at Harvard for a couple years with a couple of new projects on Middle East and international diplomacy. She's now at MIT. And so it's been a long path, but once again, she's returned to Santa Barbara, and she's with us today to talk about the issues of building legitimacy when security is not enough. Ambassador Barbara Bodine, thank you so much for coming back and joining us.
Thank you.
Nice to be back, always very nice to be back, and I can assure you, having left Boston yesterday morning when it was 6 degrees below zero, it is very nice to be here indeed. I can drag this lecture out for a couple of weeks, given the weather back east. And for any purist who was watching the slideshow, the ship that was shown was the merchant vessel Lindbergh that was bombed after I had left. That was not the USS Cole. I don't want somebody to kind of go, good God, they can't tell the difference between a merchant ship and a warship. So that was the Lindbergh. Yeah, that was it. I haven't had an introduction quite like that one. But it is nice to be back. I have to say that when I was a student here, like all of you, I had always wanted to go into the State Department and go into diplomacy. I really very much underestimated what kind of a life I would end up having. And could you please take that down? please take that down. Take that down. Mr. Sam, please take down that photo. Thank you. But I can say that while there were definitely some days in the Foreign Service where I kind of wished I was someplace else, I never once had a day where I wished I was doing something else. It was probably the best career that I ever could have imagined. And ended up being involved in an awful lot of very positive as history as well as some unfortunate events. And what I'd like to talk to you today about is Iraq. I should say that when I left Iraq the first time in 1983, I really thought that was the end of it. I had managed to survive 3 years in Iraq with Saddam Hussein, and I never had to see him, his regime, or Iraq ever again. And then I was in Kuwait in 1990 when I did end up seeing the Iraqis again, and ended up going back yet a third time in 2003, right after the statue fell. So I went back into Iraq almost 20 years to the day from when I had left, and found an Iraq that in many ways was very much the same as it had been 20 years before, and in many ways fundamentally changed. I think we all thought that however guided or misguided our intervention was in 2003, that certainly 4 years later we would still not be talking about Iraq, but unfortunately we are. And what I'd kind of like to go through today is some of my observations and views on Iraq. Certainly the sort of Iraq that would emerge from the ashes of Saddam's regime was not one of the major topics in the American domestic debate as we were looking forward toward the invasion. Our objective then was regime change, not nation building. We assumed that there would be an intact bureaucracy, there would be a redeemable army, absent the Ba'ath Party, the Revolutionary Guard, and other instruments of Saddam's control. We had an unabashed belief in the concept of imposed democracy, which I feel is an oxymoron, and that the successor government, in any event, would be stable, unitary, and friendly. Iraq, we were told, would become a beacon of democracy in the new Middle East, that we would redraw the map of the region, set history on a new course, our timetable, our vision, and our people. This was by no means the compelling rationale for the war, but as other reasons and rationales and excuses for the invasion fell by the wayside over time, the transformational power of freedom, if only by process of elimination, became front and center. We would create a new Middle East to match our national values and our strategic interests. My grandmother always warned me, be very careful what you pray for, you might get it. We have redrawn the political map of the Middle East, and we have set history on a new course. The hubris, however, that we could control, dictate, shape, and determine what that course and what that map would be has been both our tragedy and Iraq's. After 4 years, an occupation that was only supposed to last 4 months and not really be an occupation at all, has left an Iraq that is not stable, not unified, and not friendly. Our friends in the region are more embattled and less secure than they were 4 years ago, and our enemies are stronger. We can debate how we got into this, and we need to do that very candidly and openly. We also need to look forward and debate next steps with equal candor. The debate over the future of the U.S. policy toward and U.S. forces in Iraq reflects judgment on what constitutes success or victory. At what point and on what basis can we declare victory and just go home? And unless we intend to annex Iraq or keep it as a permanent dependency, we will be going home. Is it victory, which would be security, or is it success, which would be legitimacy? And can you prioritize or sequence those two? Such judgments reflect understandings and assumptions on why we went in the first place. How can you judge whether you have attained your objectives unless you can agree on what they were to begin with? It is not unlike Alice's conversation with the caterpillar. Such judgments also reflect understandings and assumptions about the motivations and the makeup of the Sunni insurgents, the Shia militia, foreign jihadis, and the neighbors. And such judgments reflect understandings and assumptions on what the Iraqi political structure can reasonably be expected to become. Finally, such judgments reflect understandings and assumptions on how much control, even influence, the U.S. has over the security or the legitimacy in Iraq. The American public debate most often defaults to security, to victory as the prime or sometimes only the sole criteria. The reality of mounting American casualties, the daily civilian carnage in Baghdad, the financial burden of the continuing war, and the war's impact materially, politically, morally, on our ability to pursue other national security interests, including Iran, Israel, Palestine, and beyond, registers with the American people. This was in evidence on November 7th. It was in evidence in the president's address on January 10th. And it is in the ongoing debate in Congress over the surge. Questions of sustainable political legitimacy, of success, do not really register quite as strongly in the public debate. And when it does, it is generally as a means for our withdrawal rather than an end in itself. So which is it, security or legitimacy? Conventional wisdom and current policy would dictate that security has to come first, that victory has to be our objective. One astute observer of Iraq described the security environment as follows. The reborn Iraqi polity has been marked by escalating violence embodied in a homegrown insurgency, rampant crime in an environment of endemic lawlessness, an ongoing alien military occupation, the flowering of militias linked to political parties, and the emergence of Iraqi security forces that remain weak, lack discipline, and are prone to violating human rights. The monopoly over violence, in other words, has become diffuse, and this vastly complicates the task of state building, which additionally has to accommodate the rise of religiosity and Islamic activism. That statement, by the way, was written 18 months ago. What we are facing today is not new. It's just our coming to terms with it that is new. It is very difficult to imagine a legitimate government anywhere absent an acceptable level of security and stability within and provided by the state. A basic function of any state is a reasonable measure of personal and communal security. Therefore, any talk of legitimacy has to begin with security. Security also has the advantage that it can be measured, whether it is how many Iraqi troops we have trained, what ratio of Iraqi troops to American troops, or more recently, how many neighborhoods have been cleared. If you shoot enough of the bad guys, put enough force boots on the ground, at some point, you round up enough of the usual suspects, you can attain security and the problem will go away. When our priority was on training, it was often explained to skeptics with a reference to T.E. Lawrence, which was, it is better the Arabs do it tolerably than you do it perfectly. This combination of soft bigotry of low expectations and the stunning arrogance in the statement does say a great deal. President Bush's repeated statements that we will remain in Iraq however long it takes to guarantee victory also begs the question of whether we believe the Iraqis will ever be able to stand on their own. And in fact, the policy on the table today has even more to do with ourselves. The surge is an admission that the Iraqis either cannot or will not provide security critical to the functioning of the state. To stay until victory is guaranteed has been tweaked to stay until the Iraqis can not only clear, but hold and build. However, it is wrapped up in assurances of Iraqi troop contributions, the president's decision to move from General Casey's 2 divisions to General Petraeus's 5 divisions is an admission that the U.S., not Iraq, will have to fight this war. It would be prudent, however, to remember the next line in Lawrence's quote. It is their war, and you are there to help, not to win it for them. And a corollary of his, the less apparent your interference is, the more your influence. What's the argument for security first? We've heard them all before, so I will only go through them very quickly. One of them is the U.S. decision, a U.S. decision to pull troops would signal defeat, and the jihadis, the insurgents, the militias, would be able to claim credit for having driven us out. In the global war on terrorism, this would embolden our enemies, and therefore their full destruction has to be assured. The U.S. decision to leave an intensely corrupt, divided, and dysfunctional or authoritarian regime would be seen by Iraqis and others as callous and short-sighted as our abandonment of Afghanistan in 1989, the betrayal of the Shias and the Kurds in 1991, or the looting of Baghdad in the spring of 2003. And then there is also where all that stands between Iraq and full civil war. National Security Advisor Brzezinski had a somewhat Darwinian take on this last one, where he believed that we should just leave, let the Iraqis sort it out. He assumed that the Shia and the Kurd would be able to take care of the Sunnis, and that the ensuing bloodbath would be tragic but a necessary rite of passage towards a viable, if slightly less pluralistic, Iraq. And there is a concern that to withdraw would allow or force the neighbors to take sides in a regional conflict that would end up as just a broader conflagration. Taken together, then, the future of U.S. troops thus comes down to our capacity and the capacity of U.S.-trained Iraqis to impose, enforce, and maintain security. In other words, we're not talking about peacemaking or peacekeeping forces. We're talking about security-making and security-keeping forces. But security and stability as ends in themselves are short-term, relative, and potentially counterproductive. Security is not an acceptable or an appropriate answer to occupation success. An occupation is successful when the political and security interests of the region are guaranteed well beyond the end of the occupation. The more complex challenge, therefore, is to leave behind an Iraq that is viable, sustainable, provides for its citizens, and is not a threat to its neighbors. The basic maxim of counterinsurgency doctrine is that you can never win militarily. You can lose militarily, but you can never win militarily. Counterinsurgency, communal violence, civil wars are all political. That is where they are fought, that is where they are won, and that's where they can be lost. The difference between short-term security and long-term sustainable legitimacy is reflected in the new U.S. Army Field Manual on Counterinsurgency Operations, which we all know General Petraeus had a major role in. The field manual recognizes the importance of legitimacy as the main goal, accepts primacy of political objectives, and recognizes that security can only be established under the rule of law. It describes legitimacy as the selection of leaders in a manner consistent and considered just and fair by a substantial majority, popular participation and support for the political process, a low level of corruption, and a high degree of regime acceptance. The issue, therefore, is not the size of the Iraqi military or police force. The issue is legitimacy, not the legality, but the legitimacy of the Iraqi government. An army or a police, absent a legitimate state, is simply a house of cards. It is hollow, and it will not be able to stand. So what's legitimacy? Well, legitimacy has been described by one author as when the articulate members of a population are by and large satisfied with the government's actions in the areas of identity, participation, distribution, equality, sovereignty, according to the norms they believe in. It includes accountability, transparency, participation, and particularly rule of law, with rule of law the first among equals. If security is the capacity to impose and maintain and enforce order, legitimacy is the capacity to create compliance. Legitimacy explains why rules and rulers are accepted. Police authority, if you think about it, comes from acceptance that the rules that they are enforcing are legitimate and that they are enforced fairly and equitably. Conversely, when the perception of the ruled is that the police or the army reflect and enforce a structure and a process that is neither fair nor equitable, that their loyalty is first to a person, a sect, or an ethnic group, then compliance has to be enforced. If the state is in control, as it was under Saddam, compliance can be enforced and guaranteed by fear. In fractured societies such as Iraq today, you have parallel security structures. Another element of legitimacy is outcome. It is a fairness and inequality and justice in the distribution of the goods and services. And the converse of that is corruption and cronyism. For almost the past 4 years, sustainable economic investment and sustainable political and economic development have been delayed and derailed for immediate and urgent requirements of security, stopgap construction measures, and frog march political calendars. Millions, if not billions, have been allocated to police and military training, yet there has been a demonstrated unwillingness to invest a fraction of these funds into any kind of institution building. And this predates the beginning of the insurgency. In February of 2003, before we even went into Iraq, then Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld vetoed a $30 million Department of Justice rule of law project as too expensive. To date, both the U.S. occupation and the series of interim and now elected governments has manifestly failed the legitimacy test as well as a security test. Let me turn it around and say what legitimacy is not. And legitimacy is not determined by a set of events and entities that just check a box called democracy. It's not elections, it's not a written constitution, it's not a parliament, at least not those solely. Those are the hallmarks of a legitimate government if they reflect a social contract between the government and the citizens. There are more than enough hollow elections, impotent parliaments, and dusty, unread constitutions in Iraq's immediate neighborhood already. And under Saddam, I think it's worth remembering, there was a written constitution, there was a parliament, and there were elections. There's been a lot of talk about the steps that Iraq has taken so far. But in a post-conflict environment, elections, even free and fair ones, as we have seen, can be divisive rather than unifying, and parliaments can reinforce rather than transcend subnational loyalties. And while the Iraqi constitution airs grievances and seeks to redress past inequities, it does very little to build towards a unified and viable central state. In fact, as currently written, it enshrines Shia majoritarianism and Kurdish autonomy, with the Sunnis be damned. The constitution does not reflect a new social order. Many of the presumptions and resulting policies of the U.S. administration going into Iraq exacerbated many of the divisions that we now see in Iraqi society. We did not create them, but the lines were drawn far more emphatically. Iraqi need, therefore, to defragment itself, therefore, as a part of an effort to reverse the impact of U.S. policies. Some observers explicitly discount legitimacy as a valid criterion. They dismiss the notion of a credible governing structure in the new term in Iraq, at least anything that approximates our notion of a Western-style liberal democracy. They argue that Iraq is inherently violent, irreparably divisive, and eternally undemocratic, if not simply ungovernable. Stop the chaos and stop the carnage. Whether this means the reinstallation of a highly centralized authoritarian government, kind of a Saddam light, or a loose confederation that the state essentially ceases to exist really does not matter to this school. And if the Iraqis cannot or will not do it, then we must do it for them. At the other end of the table, there are still those who remain convinced that Iraq is going to be the beacon of democracy in the Middle East. And while their voices are recently muted, they have not forsaken their conviction that democracy can be imposed, that it is our obligation to impose it, and that the judgment of history will be that not only were our motives and intentions noble, but that we actually prevailed. The belief that freedom in and of itself is transformational, that regime change would be sufficient to call forth spontaneous nation building and democracy, was simplistic, ill-informed, or a very cruel hoax. Oddly, the transformational school is as dismissive as the Darwinians that they're is any Iraqi national identity, but what distinguishes them is the abiding conviction of our ability to shape events. It is, however, I think, a disservice to the Iraqis to believe that they can aspire to no more than a benign but a strong leader. To expect a government that is credible, national, and legitimate, and is on the path towards the evolution of some Iraqi-style democratic governance, I do believe is reasonable, and is the critical component to our future policy and presence. It is equally a denial of history to contend that there is no Iraq, that it is an artificial state doomed to violence, and thus the greatest kindness is to put it out of its misery and accept, if not encourage it to do so. The Baker-Hamilton report makes clear that de facto, much less de jure partition, what David Brooks called soft partition, along sectarian and ethnic lines, is unnecessary, unworkable, impractical, and unsupportable. Even with the neighborhood cleansings and vast refugees and displaced persons, and the current estimate is between 1 and 3 million Iraqis out of 25 Iraqis have been displaced, Iraq does not divide into three neat pieces. It is and has been for centuries, if not millennia, a mosaic of 27 ethnic and religious groups that are both geographically and personally interconnected and highly intermarried. Most tribes are a mix of Sunnis and Shia, and while most Kurds are Sunnis, there are Shia Kurds. Iraq had a pre-Saddam history and even a Saddam-era experience of sectarian and ethnic coexistence and accommodation. Iraq is not, some analysis to the contrary, Yugoslavia. It is not a cobbled-together state made up of medieval fiefdoms. It does not have a history of communal violence or of civil wars. And it has no historic borders where you could draw these new three lines. Looking at a broader history, I can think of no examples of ethnic and religious partitions that work and that end the violence. On the contrary, if you look at most partitions, they simply add to the violence and prolong it. It is simply another form of failure, and if one failed state in the Middle East is bad, I completely miss the logic as to why three would be better. I think it's instructive to look at the long-term consequences of India-Pakistan, the de facto separation in Cyprus, and then look at Lebanon and Rwanda and decide whether or not partition solves the problem. The problem is, for American policymakers and the public debate, that legitimacy, unlike security, is not easy to quantify and it's almost impossible to teach. It's not finite and it's not concrete, and it certainly cannot be imposed or granted. But there are a number of factors that make up legitimacy that can be encouraged, supported, and fostered. And public confidence in a credible process towards a legitimate state can be a satisfactory indicator if it's matched by resources, fiscal, financial, monetary, and human. For example, recognition of the need to fairly and equitably provide services, including security services, but it also has to include education, health, basic infrastructure. That requires the allocation of resources, the training of technocrats, and the creation of a professional civil service. Recognition of the need for rule of law is not just a criminal code, but an independent judiciary, not just a police force, but the training of justices, lawyers, court clerks, and the rest of the support system. Rule of law has been described as the most critical factor in the return to a sense of normalcy in any post-conflict environment. Recognition of the need for accountability and transparency and public integrity can be supported through tough anti-corruption legislation, creation of watchdog organizations, and a viable, visible, and independent press. And transparency and accountability are also fundamental to the process of rulemaking, if that is to be accepted as legitimate. And finally, the recognition of the need for participation can be supported through the development of civil society, not just electoral mechanisms. If the development of legitimacy in a viable state is as important to the U.S. as dealing with the security, then I do think there needs to be a shift in U.S. policy and priorities. And these are not resource intensive. One is to shift from a withdrawal mentality to transition. And this is not just a transition from the U.S. military to the Iraqi military, but a transition to a more normal political relationship between Iraq and the United States, where we cease our role as enablers of the political process. With this comes the need to change our profile from one of proactive and publicly participatory in the process to proactive but discreetly participatory. We need to recognize that our highly visible involvement in the process, including the withholding or granting of endorsement of political leaders, is inappropriate and unhelpful. Similarly, we need to support the process but stay away from the provisions. And in this, I'm referring specifically to the constitutional revision. We should support a constitutional review process, but we should avoid any public involvement as we did in the past, or identification with specific provisions. We need to work with the provinces but also speak to the center. There is some confusion in the debate between the understandable wariness of a strong central authority, as they had under Saddam, and the need for a strong Iraqi state. A strong state and a functioning, albeit somewhat asymmetrical, federal system can coexist. The institutional capacity and political credibility problems, however, that plagued the central government are magnified on the provincial level, and the call for early provincial elections, I think, is very misguided. Efforts to decentralize power and authority at the provincial levels, while because they are weaker, could actually weaken the viability of the state. Furthermore, and I think this is even more important, it is possible to speak to the national identity while recognizing regional, sectarian, and ethnic differences. Iraqis can and do manage multiple identities. More emphasis needs to be placed on identifying and working with the centripetal forces as well as countering the centrifugal forces. We have to commit the funds and the political will. And finally, we need to internationalize the transition and regionalize the dialogue. We absolutely must open a dialogue with the neighbors and with all of them. We may not share a long-term view of the structure of Iraq, but we do share a deep concern for the with short-term anarchy. It serves no one. We need to work together. The current Sunni-only regional effort by Secretary Rice is not in the spirit of Baker Hamilton, nor does it reflect the advice from our friends in the region, and I think it is perhaps fatally counterproductive. It baffles me that having reaped the whirlwind of our sectarianism in Iraq, we now seek to replicate that failed model on the rest of the region. In conclusion, I don't have any magic answers. Whether the fragmentation process can be corrected at this stage is open to question. There are too many fundamental issues on the table. There is still the nature and the structure of the state, the limits of federalism, oil distribution, the jurisdiction of the courts, and the mandate and the composition of the security forces. The lack of security is therefore more than its absence, but reflects and perpetuates the fragmentation of the state. And the fragmentation in many ways reflects the belief and the concerns that there is not yet a structure that can or will provide protection for all Iraqis. And without this belief in security and justice and fairness by the state, there cannot be any sense of legitimacy. There is, at this point, no sense of a state that will defend or deserves to be defended. The state still remains other. The occupation perpetuates the political paralysis, much as it fuels the insurgency. Our occupation blunts the necessity to make the political choices that are necessary to sustain for sustainable legitimacy. The Kurds, at first cocky, after 15 years of a major state patron, that has been tempered as they look at the vortex of a failed state to their south, an impatient Turkey to their north, and the specter of having to trade some sovereignty for survival. To the Kurds, Shia majoritarianism is as untenable to the Kurds as Baathism. The Shia arrogance of an overpromise of compensatory power and wealth has been twisted into a fear of a second American betrayal. They know that if they lose the Americans, they've lost it all again. And the Sunnis read the U.S. policy of concerted marginalization, swinging now to dreams of regained glory as America's only bulwark against Iran. None of these three groups can defeat the other one militarily, but they each have proven the capacity to wreak havoc. Geographic partition is not practical. The federalism is run amok. There is an unworkable resource allocation plan, and the militias is posing as an army, along with contradictory legal systems, is simply unsustainable. There is every need to compromise and every logic to compromise, but in the current situation, there is little incentive to compromise. We and the Iraqis do not face a choice between security and legitimacy. Security alone will be short-term stopgap measures, not unlike some of the non-sustainable reconstruction. It will not be won by a surge of a desperately finite number of exhausted American troops for an indefinite period of time in the midst of a grotesque communal violence. The president ended his speech in January that the region is watching a young democracy fighting for its life. He described Iraq as the only functioning democracy in the Middle East with rule of law and fighting terrorists. Yes, the region is watching Iraq and is watching us, but not in the ways he seems to think. Few in the region believe that Iraq is a democracy. If Iraq is the beacon of Iraq as the beacon of democracy has actually become more of a flashing warning light on the perils of unilateral preemptive action and radical democratization. King Abdullah of Jordan has watched the birth of our new Middle East and has seen it not so much as the dawning of freedom, but one of violence and extremism. He looks around and sees three civil wars on his borders, in Lebanon, in Palestine, in Iraq. There is an old saying from American campaigns, an old question from American campaigns: are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And unfortunately, for too many in Iraq and for the region, the answer would have to be no. Thank you. Anybody have any questions?
So let's have an opportunity for questions. And if you could, please come down and form a line here and speak into the microphone. So that way, Ambassador Bordine can hear you easily, and we can see you on television.
I remember reading about the conflict when you were appointed in the State Department and the Defense Department. Could you talk a bit about what the, initially you were appointed and there was opposition to your appointment, if I'm not wrong, and reading the news I read in 2003, there was opposition from the Defense Department. And then further on, the question of de-Ba'athification and destruction of the military,
mm-hmm.
Disbanding.
Right.
Whose idea was that, and what was the logic behind it?
Okay. There was an article, I believe, in the Washington Times in the middle of April of 2003 that said that I had been forced on the Department of Defense by the State Department. And anyone who knew what was going on in Washington at the time, the idea that the State Department was in the position to force anything on the Department of Defense was kind of ludicrous. I was not forced on them at all. There was always an understanding there would be a senior State Department person among the Reconstruction leadership. I went over, I interviewed for a job, I gave them my resume, I met with all the right people. Mr. Rumsfeld knew I was there, Mr. Wolfowitz, Mr. Fife, and certainly Jay Garner. So this was kind of, this was the Washington Times. Trying to make the case that somehow I had been forced. I was not forced at all. And as I said, the State Department wasn't in that position. There was a debate going on between the Department of Defense and the Department of State on the assignment of six other ambassadors to the Reconstruction effort, and they were going to be the advisors to key ministries. And that was being held up in Washington because of some of these bureaucratic discussions. But at that point, I was already in Iraq. So that part isn't true. It's a great story, but just be careful what you read in the Washington Times. The other question was who had the decision on de-Ba'athification and demobilization. I wasn't around for either of those, but everything I have read and heard, not from the Washington Times, was that particularly the demobilization was taken at the Department of Defense when Jerry Bremer was in his consultations prior to coming out on May 11. Decision was made in a couple of days without consultation to any of the other elements of the U.S. government, without reference to General Garner, who was running the reconstruction in Baghdad at the time, really without reference to almost anyone. The de-Ba'athification was also taken at the same time. My own particular belief is that, first of all, it reflected a lack of understanding about both the role of the Army and the Ba'ath Party. It presumed on one level that it confused the Iraqi National Army with the Republican Guards and other instruments of Saddam's regime. And the fact that Saddam did not fully trust the army is why he created the Republican Guard. So we were basically punishing the Iraqi army for being national when Saddam had already punished them by creating the Revolutionary Guard. So our inability to make those kinds of distinctions. The Ba'ath Party, you know, the problem with that was it went so far down. You know, the worst example is, you know, librarians at elementary schools. And it basically unemployed almost all of the technocrats in the country. So what you had was, you know, the National Army was gone, the civil service was gone, the technocrats were gone, the middle class was crippled. And those elements of building a state, we marginalized and excluded. And then, as I said, we compounded that by establishing the interim government based on these three sectarian percentages. And if you wanted to be, however, very conspiratorial, which I, of course, would never be, but if you were, you know, if I were an Iraqi and I wanted to take power, one of the things that I would want to do would be to neutralize the two elements that could challenge me, and that would be the army and the Ba'ath Party. So, but I wouldn't want to, you know, imply that an Iraqi exile with close ties to the Department of Defense might have recommended that.
But you were part of the transition team, presumably. You were supposed to be part of the whole reconstruction process. How were you intending to do it differently? Mm-hmm. And what happened? How come we weren't able to do it?
Well, the reason we weren't able to do it, of course, was the decision was taken in Washington, and Jerry Bremer, when he came out, this was, I think, coalition order number one and number three was a demobilization and de-Ba'athification. What we were doing when I was first there is, for example, I was responsible for Baghdad City, which is about 7 million people and somewhere between a quarter and a third of all of Iraq's population. So somebody said it's a little bit like being in charge of California from Los Angeles to the Mexican border. It's me and my staff of 15. When we went to the mayoralty and were dealing with the director generals and the deputy mayors, the mayor was a senior Ba'ath Party official and he was long, long gone. But what I said to the senior administrators of the city, and my colleagues were saying this in the various ministries, was that we don't particularly care if you were a member of the Ba'ath Party or not. We care if you are competent. We care if you are corrupt. We care if you were doing your job. We care if you were abusing your power. But those are the criteria that we were going to use. We understood that for a vast number of Iraqis, particularly, again, technocrats, civil servants, that membership in the Ba'ath Party was not wholly voluntary. And as one Iraqi explained it to me, that he had managed to sort of duck having to join the party for most of his life, but that at a certain point his eldest daughter was about to go to university. She had applied for it and been accepted to Baghdad University, which is their best university. And he was told, if you want your daughter to go to university, you have to join the party. He joins the party. So that was the kind of person that we were punishing with our broad de-Ba'athification and the kind of what we were losing. Our idea and what we had been doing earlier was sorting people out by competency, not by their party.
I
think I do. Basically, how much of this was, how much of the problems could have been foreseen and how much was determined by policy?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, nobody has you know, could judge perfectly what was going to happen. But there were a couple of key decisions that were made that, you know, now that I'm in the academic world, I'm learning all this academic jargon like path determination. And decisions such as, there had been an 18-month study group, the Project for the Future of Iraq. 18 months, 250 Iraqis, all elements of the U.S. government, academic experts, you know, anybody who knew anything about Iraq, post-conflict, you know, post-conflict reconstruction, all of that, had been working on, you know, if the Saddam regime is removed, how do you rebuild this state politically, socially, in terms of physical infrastructure. The decision by the Department of Defense when they got the lead in January of 2003 was they were not, and this, the plan was about this much. I mean, it's measured in board feet. Department of Defense, Office of the Vice President, White House's decision was that that plan had absolutely no standing whatsoever, could not be mentioned, could not be referred to, was not drawn upon. To me, more critically, the people who had been involved in the plan were explicitly excluded from the reconstruction team that went into Iraq in April of 2003. So the more you knew about the reconstruction of Iraq, the less your chances of getting a job in the reconstruction of Iraq. Doesn't make sense to me. By excluding subject matter experts, excluding a pre-existing plan, excluding the planners, you know, we set ourselves up for not being ready for what hit us. And so even though we had Army War College, RAND Corporation, you know, everybody, we had all these studies, all of that was excluded. So in that sense, you know, yes, we are very much responsible for what happened, because a plan is not a rigid document. I mean, if you have a plan, you know, you're not, in fact, that's almost as bad as not having a plan at all, as if it's too rigid. But it gives you a framework, something to work within. If you don't have a plan, you really, in a sense, can't adapt. And so we were, you can't ad hoc your way through an invasion and a reconstruction, and that's what we were trying to do. So when things happened that were not part of their calculations, they didn't have any adaptive mechanisms. The fact that a lot of these things that happened had been predicted, such as the insurgency, I think just compounds the fact that there were policy decisions, there were strategic decisions that were taken that, in a sense, condemned us to make the mistakes that we did.
You had touched on the lack of national identity that is present among the Iraqis right now.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, what are some suggestions that you have for the U.S. to do or not to do in order to bring back a sense of national identity as opposed to the regional or sectarian identity that seems to be, you know, going on in the region?
Right. Yeah, I think, well, the question is, you know, how do we bring back the Iraqi national identity? I think first thing that would be very useful is if we would start talking about an Iraqi national identity. We still have a tendency to talk in terms of these subnational identities. And, I mean, I have a lot of respect for Les Gelb and Senator Biden and some others. But their idea that you can break Iraq into three pieces is still a lack of recognition that there is an Iraqi identity, that you can break this state apart. Walking this back is going to be very hard. There are no, you know, what is it, in golf it's called a mulligan when you get to take it again. There aren't any mulligans in foreign policy. But I think that there is a lot that we could do in terms of our approach, our language, to recognize national identities. Unfortunately, what we're doing is going the opposite direction. What we've got going now is, with Secretary Rice is out in the, as I said, having not gotten the identity thing quite right in Iraq, we're now doing it in the whole region. We are talking about moderates and extremists, you know, good guys and bad guys. The way it's coming out, though, is that the Sunnis are all moderates and the Shias are all extremists. These are all good guys. And so we're now dividing the Middle East into bisectarian identity as opposed to national identities. And we're actually compounding the problem. We need to back up. And I don't think Iraqi national identity is dead in Iraq. I think that, you know, even with all the violence that's going on, it is still in the sense of being in Iraqi. You don't have people. You have the Kurds who talk about some independence, but they understand that that is really more something they keep on the table than something they will try to do. They understand that a Kurdistan would not be viable. Even within the Shia, al-Hakim is the only one who talks about a Shia autonomous region. So you don't really have within Iraq a sense of pulling the state apart. There's a battle for Iraq going on, not a battle to pull it apart. So a lot of it, I think, is up to us. It's going to be very hard. I mean, you have a cycle of violence that's going on now that is self-perpetuating. And breaking that's going to be very hard. But it is possible. And if you look at other somewhat similar situations where you've had an ethnic or a religious divide, people can come back to their national identity if given the opportunity. I don't know exactly how you would do it, but I do know it can be done. We have to change our attitude as well as pushing the Iraqis to.
It seemed like open up communication seemed like it'd be a good theme in what you're talking about. I was wondering how to open up more internal communication within Iraq between different sects, specifically violent sects, and how the U.S. could possibly help facilitate that, or neighboring nations could help facilitate that.
Right. Well, I mean, except on the fringes, a lot of these people, they already know each other. I mean, we don't really have to set up those kinds of conversations. They probably know each other better than we know them. I think one of the things that we have to come to terms with is that our ability to really influence a lot of these events is diminishing kind of geometrically every day. And it's going to be very. It would be very odd for us to try to go in and suddenly be the matchmaker amongst these three groups. And I think that's one of the reasons that in the Baker-Hamilton report, which I think is the best thing that's been put on the table recently and that I've seen, really puts a great deal of emphasis on the need to talk to the regional actors and get them involved. One way of trying to bridge some of these gaps, however, is, again, to change the nature of the dialogue. One person has suggested, you know, particularly within the parliament, finding ways of encouraging with a very light touch. You know, us dictating doesn't work. But encouraging debates on issues, doing issue-based debates as opposed to sectarian-based debates. And that kind of gets you more national. For example, Sunni farmers, Shia farmers, and Kurdish farmers probably have more in common with each other than a Shia farmer will have with a Shia urbanite, many of the ways that we kind of divide up. So if you can kind of push some of that kind of debate, we should have been doing that in the first place. And that's why putting things in neat boxes didn't work. But you can start changing that. But I think we have to kind of get away from this almost kind of this, you know, what people call kumbaya diplomacy, which I think is probably two generations beyond you guys. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. We all hug.
Yeah, we all hug and you know, drink wine. Warm, fuzzy diplomacy, that just putting people in the same room and getting a dialogue going is really not going to solve problems. You have to have a basis and a series of issues and interests with which to bring them together, not just, you know, if everybody talks, we'll all get along.
One of the things that Baker-Hamilton report suggested was that a lot of the issues in the Middle East are related. Issue in Israel and Palestine, Syria, Iran, Iraq. I assume you agree, but could you explain, tell us how?
Well, I mean, I think it's yes. And I think one issue that we've had with our Iraq policy is that we really have tried to do Iraq as if it was, you know, had big walls around it, that it was not connected to the rest of the region, and it absolutely is. These are their neighbors. These are their national interests in one case. I mean, you look at the size of Iraq, you look at the resources of Iraq, you look at its traditional role in the Middle East. You know, it's one of the great countries there. What happens in Iraq is going to affect everyone else. how this comes out in terms of it's a failed state or not will have an impact on Syria and Jordan and others. If it is a failed state, what does that do in terms of, again, continuing to be a breeding ground for terrorism? You've got, however, I think, another element going on here, and this is a little bit harder to maybe to articulate, for me to articulate, is Israel, Palestine, Syria, Iran, even some of the issues in Lebanon. One of the basic problems with American diplomacy, I think, in the last 6 years is that we're not engaged. We are not talking, we're probably not talking to more parties in the Middle East than there are parties we are talking to. And we have a habit, and you know, I heard it just the other day from Secretary Rice, that we don't need to talk to the Syrians, they know what to do. We don't need to talk to the Iranians, they know what to do. We still have this dictating approach. We're not bringing people into conversations, we're not making it a dialogue. We don't understand what the average Arab is seeing when they watch Al Jazeera or Al Arabiya or any of the others, and they see what's going on in Iraq, they see what's going on in Palestine, they see what's going on in southern Lebanon, and they see it as a whole. It is in terms of their political consciousness. They are all related elements of occupations, lack of political rights, being dictated to, not being treated as full partners. You could solve any one of them. It would be nice to solve any of them. And it won't necessarily mean bring peace and harmony to the entire region, but to the extent that we allow them to fester, that you know we have not had a peace process with Israel, Palestine in 6 years. This may be the first administration that ever talked about a two-state solution, but we've done nothing. There is a sense that you know, to be honest, put it very bluntly, that Arabs are two-dimensional, that they're not part of the program. And until unless we change that, there is the sense that we are implacably hostile to the region uniformly, because we treat it uniformly.
And 5 years from now, 10 years from now, are we still going to be talking about Iraq?
Oh, I hope not. Or I hope we're talking about Iraq as, you know, my goodness, isn't it wonderful how it managed to work itself out. If we're still talking about Iraq in these terms in 10 years, then we will be talking about a lot of other problems. This is not a problem that can continue for another 10 years. I don't think it can continue for another 5 years. And I personally am not convinced that you can even kick this can down the road for another 2 years. There has to be the beginning of a resolution. Or I personally see Iraq becoming a vortex that basically pulls in the rest of the region. I've been working on the Middle East almost since I left Santa Barbara. And while it has its ups and downs and is always a very volatile region, I have never seen it as close to conflagration as I have seen it right now. And if it does set off, then we're going to be dealing with it in ways that we cannot even imagine 5 or 10 years from now.
Well, that sober thought, I want to thank you so much for coming and informing us. Thank you so much, and welcome back.